Welcome, Green Future Growers, Progressive Radio Network listeners, and anybody who's new to the show. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer, and let's get growing. Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast today. It is Sunday morning, April Fool's Day, Easter Sunday, 2018. We still have snow on the ground here in Montana. But I have one of the most awesome rockstar millennials you are going to hear on my show. I know you're going to love this interview. His name is Tyson Gersh from the Michigan Urban Farming Initiative. So welcome to the show, Tyson.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for talking this morning. And I know my listeners are going to love this interview. So go ahead and tell people a little bit about yourself and the Michigan Urban Farming Initiative.
So we're a nonprofit based in Detroit's North End neighborhood. We've got a 3-acre campus, and the work we do tends to fall into one of three categories. So first being addressing structural quality in the food system through the increased access of locally sourced produce. Second being driving innovation in blue and green infrastructure through piloting cost competitive models for blight deconstruction. Third, sort of challenging the traditional urban development paradigm and the role of green infrastructure in that through piloting this America's first sustainable urban agrihood model. It's a really we're doing a lot more, I think, than we intended to when we started, which is a blessing and a curse. We're 100% volunteer run, and yeah.
Okay. I got to say, that was a lot of descriptive words in a very short amount of time. And listeners are probably saying, what is an agrihood? Because I saw the amazing videos, but since we're audio, we're going to have to describe that a little more. So you're in Detroit, and I do have some awesome other rockstar millennial guests I talked to, Tess Bazinski and Adam, I want to say his last name is Pruitt, and Tess and Adam and Jamie Todek, all are from Detroit, and they talked about growing mushrooms, and they're just some great episodes also. But we're going to talk about agrihoods today. Can you have to explain like what an agrihood is?
An agrihood is an emerging residential development strategy that basically is taking a working farm and centering it as the sort of main part of a residential development. So there's about 200 of them across the country. They're all today located in rural or suburban areas. They tend to be sort of likened to the modern sort of golf course, in that it's this often really beautiful sort of green space that is sort of leveraged as an amenity to increase the attractiveness or sort of walkability or property values or just sort of interestingness of a neighborhood. Probably the most famous example is Serenby in Georgia. If you look across the different agrihood models, they tend to be fairly high income. So it's sort of, you know, you talk to a lot of like urban planners and developers today, and the sort of, you bring up urban agriculture, and usually you get a lot of like academics super interested in it who don't totally understand the industry, because in theory it makes a lot of sense, but if you start looking at the numbers, it doesn't. As a highest and best use, urban ag isn't performing terribly well if you look at the performance of the land use kind of in and of itself. But the impact that it's been demonstrated to have on adjacent property values is like really intriguing, and may be an opportunity to sort of show what urban ag is capable of as a long-term sustainable land use in urban areas.
Wow. So I'm going to quickly back up just one step, just in case you missed it. So if you haven't seen like the videos and you're not quite grasping, so basically this is like a miniature Central Park type of farm in the middle of a community. Like how, I'm trying to like picture for listeners, like there, so there's houses all around it. It's kind of, well, the one that you've built, right? And it's in Detroit, Michigan. Is that right?
Yep. In a neighborhood called the North End.
And is it like the size of a football field or like a track at a high school? Or I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Like, how big is it visually?
The campus itself is 3 acres. The farm, the production farm, is 1 acre.
Okay. And like a typical lot is an acre or a quarter an acre? Or like what's a typical lot like in a resident? Because it seems like there's a lot of houses around it, right?
Yeah. So the campus is not where any of the housing is located. A typical lot in Detroit is 30 feet by 100 feet, at least in the neighborhood that we're in. So we are located on 3 acres. It's like 19 parcels total. And of that, 1 acre is production farm, and the other two are, you know, it's our community center. It's our intern house. It's our high density fruit orchard. It's our children's sensory garden. And then the sort of housing around is a part of that sort of like agri-hood model, but it's not within the campus itself.
Okay. And the food that's grown there, what do you do with that? Like, do people like who live in the houses come? You said it was a volunteer model. Like, do they come grow the food, or how does that all work? Do they eat the food? What do you do with the food that you grow? Do they buy the food?
All the food is free for anybody who wants it.
Oh. And who grows it? Like, the people who live near there?
It's mostly the volunteers with the nonprofit. There are people that live nearby that are involved. But we have like a ton of volunteers. And the nonprofit, I guess the best way to think about it is it's not like a community garden where people come in and sort of manage their own plot. The nonprofit basically, through its own resources, manages this farm, and then we harvest everything. And basically, if you're somebody that wants produce, you can come to the farm whenever you want, and then we'll do the harvesting for you. You can have as much of anything as you want that we actually physically have. We'll do the harvesting and then weigh it out, and it's yours. And priority is sort of given to area residents, but we don't turn anybody away.
So how long has this been here?
6.5 years.
And are you the founder? Like, is that how you, like, did you come up with this whole idea and everything, right? Like, did you come up with this in college or high school or after college? Or like, where did you see the one in Georgia and that's where you got into it? Or what's your story?
So it started something very different than it is today. I was in college. I am now sort of a college dropout because I work 80 hours a week and I haven't graduated. So I'm just going to take ownership over that and call myself a dropout because I don't know what else to do. Anyways.
Well, when I go through changes like that, I just say I graduated. Like when my real estate license like expired the day I bought my first investment property. So I'm just like, I graduated to an investment, and like, I think you could just say you graduated to an entrepreneur.
Sometimes that works. And then sometimes I'm like, what am I doing with my life? Oh my God, I have to go back to school or something. So
you got time.
But yeah.
It took me 19 years to graduate. So don't worry. And then I've been teaching for almost 20 years since then. Wait, that can't be.
Oh, wow.
That can't be, but something like that. I don't know.
So it started just as like a very small scale kind of vision to build a community garden in the city. It evolved incrementally over time. The housing angle is partly the product of a conflict that we've been having with the city here. The government in Detroit really doesn't like us. It's really unfortunate. It's such a rabbit hole if I go into the details on this, so I'll spare everyone. But basically, the city wants to just put like apartment complexes everywhere and doesn't seem to like it when residents or community groups have any kind of control over their neighborhoods. It's a bizarre sort of top-down, ruthlessly top-down culture. And we are sort of, our existence is kind of like this living testament to an alternative kind of like route for development. So it's been tense, I'm not going to lie, but basically we realized that our farm and the campus itself was driving a substantial degree of residential development on its own. The city is saying, oh, there has to be like housing here. And we're like, actually, do you realize that the farm being here has driven like $2 million worth of residential investment on its own, that in a neighborhood where we have mostly 100-plus-year-old housing stock that costs a fortune to rehab. So in Detroit, you know, you take a typical blighted home that will cost you like $200,000 to $400,000 to rehab, and after it's been rehabbed, its value, you know, if you were to sell it, the most you'd get for it is probably less than $200,000. So it's really hard to kind of find a way to get these homes rehabbed because it isn't incentivized. So you have to create these sort of novelty markets, which is effectively what our farm has done. We've managed to orchestrate this degree of investment that isn't supported by the market on its own. People are willing to effectively lose money on their homes, at least for the foreseeable future. Things are increasing, but they're willing to lose money on their homes, on the value of their homes, because the value of living near something like this farm is worth it to them. And that's like a really powerful thing, especially in a time where sort of the role of urban ag as a land use and the sort of like urban framework is really uncertain. A lot of people, especially city government, view urban ag as a transitional land use where, you know, it will do this until there's sufficient development pressure to engage in more traditional development. So a lot of the existing urban ag uses in the city are kind of like, oh, well, we might not exist in the future, and certain, you know, powers that be are banking on that. But if we can sort of demonstrate that this farm is capable of not only driving this investment and these land uses that we, you know, the city sort of claims it wants, initially, and then can also be used as an ongoing, sort of asset for the neighborhood that maintains property values and sort of like resident interest, then that's just like a really profound thing. And that's kind of where how we ended up where we are today, was sort of through this existential crisis and this lengthy battle with the city that's still ongoing, right? And the future isn't determined yet, but I don't know if we're optimistic. Now I'm rambling.
I guess I'm just confused about why are you a nonprofit then? Like, why is the farm like it can't make enough money to pay for that land because it's like really expensive land in the middle of a residential area?
Oh, no, we can pay for the land. We are not being given the opportunity to purchase it. That's kind of the problem. So we're on 19 parcels. The land that we do not own, so we own about just under half of it. When we got here, it was a number of different city departments. We went to the city's Adopt-a-Lot program. They told us that if we could demonstrate good stewardship, there'd be a clear path to ownership made available to us. And then the administration changed, and they changed their mind. They were like, oh, no, we want this land. Like, you'll never get it. It was very ugly. There's been a lot of things that have happened since then, but basically the land is owned by the Detroit Land Bank Authority now. Our stance from day one has been, name your price, we will buy it. Not because we have just an insane amount of money sitting in our bank, but because this struggle has built such a support network that we have enough sort of sympathizers willing, who have already sort of told us, like, get to the point where you can buy that land and we'll pay for it. We're not being given the opportunity to do so. It's complicated in Detroit. You know, a third of the entire city is owned by the Detroit Land Bank Authority, which is this quasi-governmental entity that isn't necessarily beholden to a lot of the policies and procedures and basically democracy that other sort of city government is. So let's talk about something else, because okay, I can talk about this and the conspiracies all day.
Okay. So I actually always start off the show talking about your very first gardening experience. Like, were you a kid? Were you an adult? Did you grow up in Detroit? Like, who were you with? What'd you grow?
So I grew up in Ann Arbor mostly. I did a lot of gardening with my mom and my grandpa. I'm sorry, my dog is barking upstairs. It's distracting.
Do you want to get
him? Edit this out. Tuna, stop barking. Okay, sorry about that.
No worries at all.
She's adorable, but she's crazy. Growing up, I grew a lot of tomatoes and eggplants, I'd say mainly, with my mom and my grandpa. I did landscaping for, it was like 7 or 8 years. So we kind of grew up doing it. And, that's kind of my gardening background experience.
And then how did you learn how to grow organically? Like with your mom and grandpa or like after that or?
It's funny. It was so long ago with my grandpa. I think that he just did everything organically, but I can't say for sure. My mom uses Miracle-Gro. It's actually a product I really like. You know, the farm itself is organic. That's just sort of the model that we've chosen to take, but I don't have this philosophical opposition to fertilizers that I think a lot of people do. I'm more neutral. I'd say I think like fertilizers play a really important role in supporting a global food system, and that they were developed at a very specific place and time, and we've sort of evolved kind of in our needs, and we're at this point where industry is sort of adapting to meet our sort of heightened consumer awareness, where we're saying, hey, you know, we're not worried about if we're eating at this point, but we're worried about what we're eating. And that's a really beautiful thing, and now industry is sort of responding to that with better products. But the farm itself is organic. I guess the way that we learned how to do it, mostly through trial and error. We spent a lot of time on Google, and we actually, I don't know if you've ever used the Johnny Seed website, but
yeah,
it's remarkable. I mean, like literally anything you want to know how to do is on there. So we just follow the instructions, and it turned out really well. The only products that we use on the farm are liquefied worm poop. We won a contest. We literally won a metric ton of liquefied worm poop. I have no idea how this sort of came to be. I mean, I do because we won it, but that has sustained us for like the last 3 or 4 years. And it's all we use, just that and water. A lot of people ask us about the soil quality. That's sort of a big concern that the general public has. We do test all of our soil, and it turns out that our soil is well below the parts per million of contaminants that the USDA requires to plant tubers. And that's often the case. So our location is on formerly residential land. I've read a thing the other day from an engineering firm, and it was basically sort of combating the stereotype and sort of saying like, hey, actually like 90% of like soil in Detroit is totally fine. You know, unless you were on a former industrial site, you're going to be okay. And that's been our experience. Not only was the soil sort of contaminant free or below the parts per million, but it was super nutrient rich. Our land had sat, I don't want to say like vacant, but without a structure on it for, I think it was like 15 or 20 years. So there was just over a decade of natural organic buildup that had occurred that just put us in really good shape for growing.
I can't imagine people aren't asked, like, where's Flint compared to Detroit?
You know, I don't know. It's close. I'm really bad at geography, if I'm being honest. I think it's like
you have nothing to worry about because you are like a. I can't understand how you don't have a degree in like public land systems and infrastructure and economics, and like not only do you know a lot about gardening and soil science, but you also have this huge like real estate, urban business or land housing knowledge background. So you
I'm good at using certain words to make it seem like I know what I'm talking about, which is a critical skill in the nonprofit phase.
I think you know more than you're saying. You're just being humble. Anyway, so, okay. So, well, this is all awesome stuff to know. And, like, I talked to this other rock star millennial, Danny Swan, who's in the, what's it called? The Ohio Valley, I think. So he's kind of somewhat near you as, like, by Montana standards. I don't know how far Ohio is from Detroit, but at least you're kind
it's of... It's close. They're the enemy. I don't know if you're aware of the Michigan-Ohio rivalry. It's completely irrational, but even when you say Ohio, my, like, brain goes red. Like, I'm just like, no, for no reason. It's close. It's adjacent. We have no reason to hate our neighbors, but it's sort of you're trained growing up to hate people from Ohio. Like, it makes no sense. I'm sorry. I have no idea why I'm talking.
That's fine. But he talked about like a reclamation project there, very similar. But where they have like, he has like a community garden that he's built in the middle of the city, but urban, very similar urban agriculture type of situation. I don't know. The similarity ends where their soil was not good to start and they've had to fix their soil.
Oh, no. Are they using like phosphor remediation or something like sunflowers or?
They use a lot of like, you know, just any kind of composting or mulching, any kind of material that they can get their hands on to just build layers and build up their soil is what they've been doing. I don't remember.
Amending. Yeah.
But yeah.
For sure.
Well, tell us about something that grew well this year.
Let's see. It's funny. This last year was the most removed I've been from the farm itself. I work like 80 hours a week on admin stuff, and it's truly hard to balance all of the field work and the admin stuff. So this year I kind of was like, all right, farm interns, like make it happen. And it was chaotic, but it was good. In terms of what grew well, I mean, we always do really well with collards. That's probably our most important crop. It's in the highest demand. We could turn the entire farm into a collard production field and still not make a dent in the demand. People love them here. So we grow a variety. We do multiple varieties. I'm sorry, let me back up. So the model that we use is really focused on crop diversity. So we have the farm kind of broken up into zones and tracks, and if we grow any category of crop or any type of crop, we're growing multiple varieties of it. So a good example is we have 22 varieties of tomatoes. We have 11 varieties of eggplant. So they come in every size, shape, and color. And if you come to our farm, you sort of get to firsthand experience that, which tends to be a really nice opportunity to sort of expose people to how our food system operates. You know, you show somebody a carrot that's purple, and, you know, they're like, I didn't know this was even a possibility. How can this be? And it's like, well, let's talk about maybe, you know, the sort of like forces behind, you know, what led you to believe that carrots were only orange. And it tends to be like a really nice way to talk about the food system and sort of how the market forces shape the way that we experience it. I'm rambling. What else grew well?
Eggplants did really well this year. Kind of we know about, like, why do you grow 11 varieties of eggplant and 22 varieties of tomatoes? Because, like, I've had other guests talk about just grow a couple. Like, does that seem challenging? And, like, how big of a space are you growing 22 variety? Like, do you have two of each variety or 10 of each variety? Like, how many tomato plants are you growing?
So we do, there's 21 plants for each variety of tomato. It's partly determined by the size of the bed.
Holy cow, so we do 18 inch spaces. Plants? More than that.
Probably, I don't know, whatever 22 times 21 is.
Wow.
I don't do math without a calculator. That's sort of my, like, commitment. Because I know I'll mess it up.
20 times 22 is going to be 440, and one more 22 is going to be 462.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
That sounds like a lot of tomato plants.
We do 18-inch spacing. We do two rows per bed. So the rows are only a foot apart, and we stagger them. We put everything on a trellis system. I think each bed has, like, it's a 10 or 12-foot T-post in it. So, and then we run tomato twine. I won't say that the way we're doing it right now is the best way, but we run, like, a metal wire between the two posts, and then, make a net out of tomato twine running down. We used to just run single wires to let the tomatoes crawl up, but it got really, like, saggy, and as the tomatoes grew and gained weight, they would just kind of pull everything down. So now we've created, like, a matrix, right? It's like a net, a mesh system that distributes that weight a little better. And frankly, I don't know why everybody doesn't just do it that way. It makes a lot more sense, and it's a lot easier if you know that you're going to do that going in. But we do the same thing for our vining hot crops. So we do that with the eggplant as well.
Well, I wouldn't have any idea what you were talking about if I hadn't gone on a farm tour at Mandy Girth's place down close to me here. So listeners, if you don't really quite grasp what he's talking about, I would say either look, there's some great videos, I think, on your website, which is the Michigan Urban Farming Initiative. MIUFI.org. They have some great videos. They're probably some on YouTube, or visit a local farmer and see what they've got going. And then it's funny because Adam Pruitt, who was one of my guests from Detroit, talked about how much he loved tying up tomatoes. I can remember him saying, or wait, was
oh
that
my God, it's so addictive. It's like you get into the zone. I will admit that, like, I spend more time than is really optimal. Like, I've pulled all-nighters on the farm. Like, I'll pull a floodlight out and just, like, run an extension cord. And you just kind of get into this groove where you got your, like, tomato twine and your pruning shears, and you're just flying through it. But then you end up spending, you know, like, 12 hours straight, no breaks on it. And you're like, what happened? It's a really, really cathartic activity.
Well, that's good to know. And I think a lot of listeners, maybe, like, I'm sure their heads are spinning. Like, there's somebody out there. I always say the right interview happens when the right listeners in the audience. And I'm sure there's, like, one or two at least people out there that are like, oh my gosh, that is totally the solution I've been looking for. I can't believe I never thought of that. It's so obvious. And yet It's not. So, like, are you following? You said something about a system. Like, is there a book or a plan or something that you're following? Or this is the system that you've created over time for the area? Did you create this system? Like, where's your guidebook?
For the tomatoes?
For everything. For your farm.
Oh, that's just such an amalgam of stuff that we found or tested or developed ourselves. There is no one living sort of document that we reference or even have to reference. But I don't know. The tomatoes, we call it, I'm trying to, you know how they have like the Florida weave and that's sort of the industry standard for tomato trellising?
No.
So the way we've identified is I'm calling it the Gersh weave, even though it's like probably not the best system. But it is sort of a unique one that we're trying to brand. Not seriously, though, mostly as a joke. But, yeah, I mean, Johnny Seed Company is probably the most our go-to resource for stuff. Like, if I want to know how to do anything, I go there first. And then I'll, like, vet whatever they say across a few different websites. And then, you know, sort of marry that with whatever our experience in the field has been.
I gotta say, I go very similar. Yep, I agree. How about something you're excited to try different or new next year? Or like, what are you gonna have your interns work on? And at some point, I'd like to hear if you have any like advice for people who are interested in bringing on an intern. Or if somebody wants to be an intern, like what you would be looking for, because I suppose a lot of my listeners are probably interested in doing that. But I have a lot of older listeners who probably are looking for people to come. I've been thinking about it'd be nice to have somebody come help Mike if we could have a woofer here or something, but we have to get a place for them to stay first.
So as far as us having interns goes, we actually just accept anybody that wants to come. It's kind of always been our policy. You know, people got to kind of figure out their own like living arrangements. So we end up having like a lot of students who have stipends or something, but anybody that wants to come, I don't think we've ever said no to anybody. And we just kind of figure we can teach anybody anything and we just kind of make it work. Sometimes it's chaotic. We get a lot of differently skilled people with different sort of professional and ideological backgrounds, but it's a good like melting pot. You get to meet a lot of different kinds of people. As far as like advice for those looking to host interns, you know, it's funny, like people that like agriculture are like an interesting group of people, especially those who have some gardening experience on their own. It's a very opinionated bunch, and what will often happen is you sort of get people that come that have their own ideas about what's best, and I think, like, it's really important to sort of, you know, you always want to, like, learn from other people, but you also have to have, like, standards for your space. And that's kind of, like, our policy. We want, like, the best strategy at all times. And we need consistency across the board because we have just so many different people coming through that standardizing is like one of the only ways we have to reduce the chaos. So when we get a volunteer, I mean, literally we have situations where volunteers go like, no, I know better. And we just feel like, hey, sorry, that's just not kind of like how we do things here. Thanks for like the input. But we have to kind of like go this route because this is the route that we already have been going, and we can like pilot that strategy, like maybe at an offsite location. But we got to kind of just keep everything the same here because it's not going to like, it'll create more work than the value it could even theoretically add to have sort of this mix happening simultaneously. So I guess like my advice is, just being prepared for very strong views on things that may directly conflict with your own, and being prepared to I guess I can handle that, but also being comfortable saying like, hey, like this is how we do things here. And, you know, you're here to learn and teach, of course, but, you gotta like respect the space and respect the culture that's been established here. If that makes sense.
Absolutely. I think you're dropping golden seeds like crazy for people on things to expect and things maybe they hadn't thought of, and they're just thinking, oh, it'd be so cool to have somebody come help me do this work and kind of to deal. But how about on the flip side? I mean, if you have all these volunteers, things are actually going really well, or you wouldn't be doing this. So like, what are some things like if somebody wants
That volunteers aren't necessarily always you know, you say you have all these volunteers and we have this assumption that like all people are equal. And I mean, we are, but like not all people kind of come to the table like equally equipped to perform the same task, like just physically, spiritually, like professionally. And volunteer management is a huge thing. It's really hard. You know, just because you have like a working body doesn't necessarily mean that like it's going to like add more value than it's going to cost. So you also have to be just really careful about, you know, how do I put it? All interns are supposed to be interns. I'm sorry. This is something that I've heard a few different places that I think is a really important thing to be cognizant of. Like an internship ethically is supposed to be a wash in terms of what it adds to the host. So the intern is supposed to take as many resources as it offers, right? So you're supposed to be investing like in educating this intern as much as you are sort of benefiting from it. Cause like the purpose of an internship isn't free labor, right? It's to teach. And so if you've kind of this idea that like internships are just going to be this like, you know, magic bullet that solve all your problems because it's like unlimited free labor, then you're not understanding the purpose of the internship, and you're going to be very surprised when you're actually having the interns.
Yep. I've always, my success with working with volunteers has always come from trying to match the person's strengths with a job. Like, so I'm going to talk about teaching, but like when I worked at Head Start or parents in my classrooms here, like not everybody wants to come and read a book to a kid, to the kids and sit. Like you think a lot for teachers. So not everybody maybe wants to come weed your garden or learn that, or maybe they want to for a little bit, but like finding something that they're really good at, like, and then matching a job to their strengths. Like I could find parents that could come, you know, plastic, put up like, dads would want to come put stuff up in on the windows to, you know, insulate for winter time. Or maybe they wanted to, a busy mom who works wanted to cut out stuff for the kids to glue, you know, cut out paper samples or things for projects. Like there, it didn't always have to be exactly like one specific thing. Or maybe a parent likes to help cook things or pre-make things or donate things. Or like there's always like, it's just to me, trying to find somebody's strengths, helping them work in their strength zone, and then making them feel extremely appreciated. Now, interns are different than volunteers. An intern is looking for college credit. A volunteer is maybe somebody who just wants to do something good out of the kindness of their heart, or maybe they're like volunteering for a CSA and they're going to get food in return. But I've definitely had other guests talk about, you know, sometimes interns can take more energy in the long run trying to teach them if they come with different skills or no skills or skills that they've learned at some other farm and you want them to do it, you know, the way that's working on your farm, like you said. So, but I definitely think there's a lot of benefits to, you know, educating people, even if it's not going to necessarily benefit you particularly. Or maybe it will once they're educated to do it your way, the way that's going well on your system. Anyway.
Yeah, volunteers are a different animal than interns for sure.
Yeah. Did we talk about something you are excited to try next year, like something new at your place?
Let's see. What am I excited about? I mean, I think right now I'm just yesterday I ordered some green Malabar. It's called like Malabar spinach, but it's not actually a spinach. It's like a climbing, viney leafy thing that it's sort of just like a purslane with big leaves that climbs and I guess tastes like spinach. I don't personally see the resemblance, but other people do, so it must exist. But in terms of like practices, I don't know. I mean, we're like rehabbing our community center right now, and that's really where my focus is, just in terms of what I think is going to add the most value to the nonprofit. In terms of like, just trying to think of like actual practices on the field. We're using some compostable mulches from BASF that we're excited about, or we're going to pilot some. But they're technically on the production site because they haven't been sort of certified as organic yet. I think they might be in the process of it, but I'm excited just to see how those perform over time.
Where are they coming from? Like the Detroit something?
BASF. It's a chemical company that's got a strong presence here in Michigan. Basically, like anything that's in your house, probably at some point in its life was came from BASF chemistry. So it's like when General Motors wants to make a wants to hear like less 0.10 decibels of echoing in a car when the passenger sneezes, like as heard from the driver's seat. BASF is like, we can calibrate a spray foam for that. So they're essentially this chemical company that sort of matches really high performance chemistry with the needs of vendors across different industries. So they have a huge presence in ag, kind of across the board. Their portfolio of vendors is really diverse. They're really impressive company. But they're sort of one of the driving forces in sort of pushing sustainable products forward as well. The future of sustainability is through chemistry. I think that we sometimes demonize just like the word chemical, but like everything is chemicals. And there's just been like this sort of, I don't know, bizarre propaganda campaign that's I think like a disservice to a lot of gardeners, especially, or they've been sort of trained to be anti anything with certain words, but that's its own sort of issue. Anyways, BASF is making like a lot of really cool products, whether they sell them directly or they're just supplying the chemistry to a company that sells it. But we have like a pretty good working relationship with those guys. And there's like a few products that they're involved in that we're excited to pilot. So that's probably, I don't know. I think that's what I'm most excited about.
Okay. So how about something that didn't go the way you thought it was going to last season? Did something not turn out the way you thought it would?
Well, we didn't finish an irrigation system setup that we've been working on that I thought we would. That's going to save us a lot of time and energy. We basically took the basement of a blighted home and converted it into a rainwater harvesting cistern that automatically irrigates the farm through this like pressurized solar powered drip line system. It's pretty cool. And it really is. I'm surprised that we've been able to kind of come up with this concept, because like if it works, which I am confident it will, it's like a very scalable model that should be implemented elsewhere. But basically we removed the superstructure, left the basement intact, lined the basement with a rubber pond liner, and then filled it with storm tank modules, which are like glorified milk crates that, you know, if you imagine you fill your bathtub up, but you stuck an upside down milk crate in it, you can stand above the water, but the tub can still hold the water. It's kind of the same concept, but the storm tank modules can hold the weight of a fire truck on them. And so you can walk on the top of this thing, you know, you wrap the top even in felt and then put some gravel around it, but it sort of creates this really, you know, a load bearing cavity that's underground that can hold a huge volume of liquid. And then we have like a pump that's outside of it. It's hidden under this like really, really convincing decorative rock that's not real, but looks really real. It's just bizarre because it's like, why is this rock here? Because we don't have like rocks on our farm. But it pulls the water out and then irrigates the farm through a drip tape system. And we're working on an added sort of feature that uses infrared technology to measure the rate of photosynthesis of each of the beds as a measure of the hydration of the crops. So the idea being that when the crops are dehydrated, it'll trigger the system to automatically irrigate them. But that's very much still under development. Hopefully, maybe we'll have that fully fleshed out this year. But yeah, I'm really excited about that getting successfully implemented. But I thought we were going to have it done last year, but we didn't. And that was a bummer.
That's awesome. A lot of my listeners say one of the biggest tips. So I made this 7 awesome ways to save time in your garden and enjoy your garden more. And one is definitely coming up with some kind of automated irrigation system. And Mike worked for this lady last year. He kind of helped her get her garden growing. And she had a really cool way to automatically water it, set it up on sprinkler because she was gone during the week and it would water while she was gone. So it was a lot. What the biggest takeaway I got from this place Mike was at was that it was a lot easier than I ever expected it would be. Like, now she's on a very small scale, or a bigger scale, but I think that's awesome to use solar panels and rainwater and anything like that. Sounds awesome. And hopefully it'll work this year for you.
Fingers crossed. Yeah, automation in irrigation the technology is there and everybody can do it. There's off the shelf stuff. You can get it at Home Depot. It's really accessible and it's very DIY friendly. I strongly recommend anyone and everyone automate their irrigation to save just an insane amount of time, money, and energy.
Awesome. Before we get to the root of things, we're going to thank our sponsors and affiliate links. Hey, Green Future Growers. Did you get your copy of the Organic Gardener podcast, Garden Journal, and Record Keeper? One of the things that I've learned to be most beneficial for my guests that will save you time and energy is to keep detailed records of your garden journey. So I think I finally found the secret and made a garden journal data keeper that starts any day of the year because you just fill it in. It's blank. There's no calendar. So it's got the days of the week. You can record temperature, freeze dates, frost dates, when you planted, what variety you got. All in one place. So get your copy of the Organic Gardener podcast, Garden Journal, and Data Keeper today. No matter where you garden, a few key practices can help prevent problems. Plants, like people, get sick when they are under stress, and I found that if any part of my garden suffers from prolonged stress, insects and disease will move in shortly thereafter. So be sure to water, weed, and check for bugs and diseases regularly. Remove sickly plants at once and dispose of them in the burn pile or trash, since disease spores don't always die in the compost pile. By spotting insects early, you can take swift measures before the problem gets out of hand. This is just a great piece of advice from Aaron Bazankian's Floret Farms Cut Flower Garden, Grow, Harvest, and Arrange Stunning Seasonal Blooms. If you haven't read this book, you definitely want to check it out if you're doing any kind of gardening, but especially if you're doing flower gardening. And you can get this book or any book at Amazon by going to theorganicgardenerpodcast.com, click on the recommended books page, and there's a link there that will sponsor or help support the Organic Gardener Podcast while getting you a great book. And now let's get to the root of things. Okay, so this is where we call getting to the root of things, and these are like easier, short questions. What's your least favorite activity to do in the garden? Is there something you got to force yourself to get out there and do? Okay, we'll come back to that. How about a favorite?
Yeah, I don't have anything off the top of my head.
How about your favorite activity? Like, what do you love the most out there?
Pruning tomatoes and trellising tomatoes.
How about the best gardening advice you've ever received?
Let's see. Off the top of my head, I don't have any like profound nugget of wisdom. But I think like if I could sort of refer to sort of like an abstract kind of principle that I've adopted that I think is really valuable is just to be very systems minded. People get really hung up on details. You know, no, let me change my answer. It's still sort of like in the principle category, but I think that there is so much misinformation and pseudoscience in the gardening community. It's mind-blowing how many things I have heard from people who will sort of speak as an authority just because they heard somebody say something once, and it's untrue. It's sort of this like this industry/community that's built on word of mouth, kind of like passed on knowledge, which is cool in and of itself. But there are so many people that are super committed to inefficient practices because of like, I don't know, because somebody said it really cool one day or they saw a meme on Facebook. And I think like, part of being responsible and part of really, really like reaching your own potential in the gardening space is to be humble one and to know that like what you have been told and what you think you know may be just completely false. And that's just like part of being a lifelong learner is that you need to sort of recognize that and be always actively seeking out new knowledge and to verify things. And to just be really discerning with the information that you receive and be really cautious about charisma. Because that's just like this big issue and that I like see a lot is you have people that are really passionate and about sort of what they think about gardening. You know, it'll be like, people that are just like in love with the idea of using, let me think of an example, like newspapers in gardening, which, you know, like isn't necessarily a bad thing, but like they're just like so in love with it and they maybe haven't even done it that much, but they'll sell the idea really well and they'll sort of insist in spaces that like this is the best way to do something. And they often end up sort of silencing people kind of like in a similar space that maybe know more than them or have like a better way. So I don't know. And I guess this, I don't want it to be like negative, but like if you really want to experience all there is to experience in gardening, then you've got to like test your own knowledge and sort of like pursue absolute like truth, at least in terms of practices, defer to science, you know, vet things, and just like, yeah, vet things. That's my biggest thing. Don't just do something because somebody made it sound good. You got to like have proof that it works. Or just be comfortable experimenting and like if your goal isn't to maximize production, like that's fine too.
Cool. I mean, to me, it kind of sounds like you're just saying just keep an open mind. And like, there's lots of things I've learned since I started my podcast that I had no idea. So I think
an open but critical mind.
Well, that's so true. I mean, critical thinking skills is like what we talk about at school all the time. Like, that's why I love the Common Core so much, because it really focuses not as much on just memorizing content. Like, I'll never forget eighth grade, where I don't know what I remember about eighth grade other than that we just had to memorize battle after battle of Gettysburg and social studies. I hated going to social studies because we spent every day. Who needs to know that? Like, it's about teaching kids how to be critical thinkers, how to understand the science. Like, one of my very first YouTube videos I made was reading this primer from 350.org on climate change, how to easily explain to people about climate science. So definitely, I would say vetting things, making sure, yeah. And media literacy, too, is another skill we teach kids a lot. You know, just because you see it on Facebook doesn't mean it's true. Like, I found this, I did exactly that. I found this, like, how to get rid of, I wanted to see if I could get rid of spotted knapweed, which is, like, one of our, invasive weeds here. And I saw this thing that you could use, like, this vinegar and salt mixture. Now, I tested it. I don't know if I did it wrong, if I probably didn't use enough, but it did not work on the knapweed. So I think that's important. Try a test. Yeah, check it out. Does this really work? Does it not really work? Anyway.
Yeah, and get comfortable using Google Scholar to verify things.
Google what? Scholar?
Yeah, it's like probably the best resource for primary source publications, you know, like academic publications. It's really useful if you're trying to, like, understand the science and sort of efficacy of something. You know, agriculture is, like, one of the oldest industries, professions, like, in human history. There's a lot of great knowledge around it, and it has been tested to death. Well, not to death, but, like, it's been very, very comprehensively sort of evaluated, because our food system is super important to, like, human survival. So there is good quality, like scientific research on everything. I did like a basically a meta analysis on like high density pruning strategies to tailor each sort of strategy per crop for maximizing production. And I was just in total disbelief at how much amazing high quality literature there was on it from universities that was tested, and you can see the numbers and you can really see what works.
Awesome. Well, maybe you should compile that into a book for the rest of us that aren't so friendly with academic.
Yeah, we are. We literally are. It's dense. Like, it can be really hard to read. We're trying to make sort of like a best practices. Here's how we did it. And here's like a hyperlink if you want to see why we did it this way.
Yeah. Awesome. How about a favorite tool that you like to use? Like, if you had to move, what's one tool you couldn't live without?
I think the brand is Hydrofarm. It's like a $10 or $7 pair of pruning shears. Pruning shears are by far, I think, the most useful tool to have on a farm. And the brand I really like, the product I really like, is the Hydrofarm. It's like this curved blade. It's got like this tiniest curve. You find them in like a lot of the pot shops or the internet. I don't know. I like don't grow pot. I don't smoke pot, but that seems to be where they exist the most. But it's like a cheap pair of shears that you don't mind if it breaks. And it's hard to break them, but eventually you will. And so you just kind of like buy a new one. I maybe buy a new one every year. And they're awesome. They're lightweight. It comes with a little belt holster, so you can just have it on you at all times. And it's got a little spring in it. It's amazing how many different things you can use that tool for.
And maybe you have a picture you can send me to put in the show notes.
Sure. Yeah. And I've tested out a number of other pruning shears, because I mean, even the ones where you have one on like one finger, so you can do like two-handed like trellising, and then you snip with like your like index and ring finger without having to hold them. I've tried the like the $80 pruning shears. By far the best ones I've had are the Hydro Farm, like cheapy $7.99. I don't know how much they are. They're really cheap pruning shears.
Cool. I'll try to find a link for them in the show notes. How about a favorite recipe you like to cook from the garden? What do you like to eat out there? College?
Oh, I don't cook.
Well, nothing that you like, you don't use the food from the garden? Do you just eat it raw, like in a salad?
Yeah, yeah. I like Sun Gold tomatoes. That's my favorite actual thing that we grow. And I like to eat them raw. But yeah, I like don't cook.
Okay. How about a favorite internet resource? Is it that place that you were saying that you go for information, the Google Scholar?
Yep, Google Scholar, and then Johnny Seed Company, their website is an incredible resource. Those guys really understand how to organize information that is intuitively navigable, sort of from the user end. They make really excellent charts and sort of like comparison documents, and they just have like a ton of resources. They've done a really good job. And of course their product is, at least in my opinion, the highest quality there is.
Excellent. How about a favorite reading material, like a book or a magazine or a blog that you can recommend?
The Johnny Seed website. I sort of view the two as one and the same. I like their catalogs. They send out emails. They'll let you know like if a particular variety is performing well, you know, like you'll get an email being like the Easter egg radishes are like this year having like an issue with this thing. So sort of be prepared, you know. They're a tremendous resource.
Cool. How about, do you have any like business advice for listeners on how to get started if they were going to start their own nonprofit or their own agrihood, or I don't know?
Don't is sort of my first advice. I say that sort of jokingly, but sort of seriously. You're not going to make money selling vegetables. And I'm like often a really unpopular person for saying this, but ag is a commodity market. Like our food system only works on subsidies, and that's fine, right? Because it means that we're all eating, and of all the things to sort of subsidize, like our food system is one of them. But selling vegetables, at least let me preface this by saying my experience is very specific to urban ag. I can't speak as much for rural ag, but selling vegetables you'd be lucky to profit at all. If you value time and energy whatsoever, it would be quite an accomplishment. It's a commodity market. There's a profit margin, and that's fine. But people, I think, need to like recognize that we often sort of romanticize what sort of urban ag, or at least agriculture, is and what it can do. And it makes so much sense when we talk about it theoretically, but if you really look at the numbers, it is not an industry that you're going to like make money on, right? It's not like step one, step two, step three, profit. It's just, that's where it is. And that's a reality. Value added products, yeah, I think you can. I think there's this really promising space. But I think in terms of really sort of like building wealth and how to put it, it's not tech, I guess, is sort of what I'm saying in a nutshell. So we shouldn't talk about it like it's tech. And I think ag is sort of in a lot of entrepreneurship spaces, but it isn't delivering in a lot of entrepreneurship spaces. So just that's my sort of philosophy and experience, and maybe if I can save somebody from it, spending a lot of time and energy building a business model that might not pan out, I hope it can. And I know it's like step positive, so I don't mean to be negative. I'm rambling.
Well, I interviewed Anastasia Cole Plakeis, who wrote the book, The Farm on the Roof, and they had a very specific business model. They wanted to be a profitable business, but she definitely talks a lot about having different branches, and education is a huge piece, using their space for events, hosting events that help bring in money. Event, like you're saying, those added... added value things that you can bring. You're probably right there, you know, but they do talk about what they grow up there, and they know, they're very into their data. They know exactly, we're going to grow this. This is how much profit we're going to make from this, you know, finding, looking at your markets and finding, you know, what you can sell in your market. Like, and I do think a lot of people idealize the idea of, oh, I want to be a farmer. I love to work outside. But like you said, you've had to step away from the garden. You have to, there's a lot of the business piece, and you have to understand that it's just like, if you're an artist, you still have to be able to market your art, or if you, you know, have to be able to sell it if it's going to be.
I don't even think it's the selling it that's the problem. It's that if we wanted to sell every ounce of what we grew, I am confident we'd have no problem doing that. We've done it. It's just that the most amount of money that you can make is very small, right? Like it is an industry that works with economies of scale, because the profit margin per transaction is so small, and that's sort of by design, right? Like what a commodity market is, and this is true even with specialty crops, cash crops, you're right. There is like so much to it, and it's like business. It's building relationships. It's having things on time. I'm sorry. I'm going like on my tangent. What you were saying about the woman in the rooftop farm is correct about sort of having diversified revenue sources. It's the truth. Like your money isn't going to come from growing vegetables ever. You'll be lucky if you break even on that. Be prepared to lose money, frankly. But people love to be around plants. They love the idea of plants. And there's a lot of sort of tangential revenue that can be made from that. Event spaces, event space models are a huge part of that. You know, we've built this place that's really beautiful, and there is quite a bit of money to be made off of that in and of itself. You know, there's this woman, and you should maybe consider hosting her on one of your episodes. Her name is Rohani Folks. She is one of the owners of a place called The Farmer's Hand in Detroit. But she's like from Australia, and she did this like graduate sort of study where she looked at all of these different farm themed businesses across the world. One of her inspirations was Argus Farm Stop in Ann Arbor, which is really amazing, and I strongly recommend people check into it. But I remember talking with her one day, and you know, she was just saying, like, she's looking at all these different businesses that have like farms involved in them, and it sort of seems like the farms are never making any meaningful amount of money, but all of the businesses that are sort of around the farms or that work directly in tandem with the farms are experiencing like a huge bump in performance. And that's sort of where farming can be really profitable or sort of lucrative is not in the act itself, but in the enhancement of performance of sort of tangential ventures. So, you know, it's not the farm in Australia, it's the Airbnb or the sort of like restaurant that's attached to it, that lets you like eat in the middle of the farm, right? It's sort of this place-based experience. And that's kind of where successful models, at least in my experience, are really finding their success is in leveraging the farming in the leveraging the agriculture to increase performance of tangential or adjacent or sort of related business ventures.
Yeah. And like I said, I think a lot of my listeners are interested in those kind of related businesses. I mean, I gotta say, I keep thinking about Jean-Martin Fortier, who's up in Toronto, who does make a decent living selling vegetables, but I don't know, maybe he has other things. I think you just have to be prepared. and think about, you know, where do you want, you know, and how much scale can you get? I mean, I think there's a certain amount to how much they can do there too. So here's my final question. If there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity organization you're passionate about or project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
I would like to see more automation technology. I think that is where the real opportunity for sustainable and scalable practices is going to come from. I think that like direct human involvement is one of the most damaging things in our planet, and the inefficiency that it creates is the removal of that inefficiency is where we stand to benefit from the most.
Interesting. All right. Well, how about an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden?
I think that there are few activities in the world that are as empowering as using your own two hands to physically shape the world around you. And I think gardening and farming is one of the best examples of that. Nothing will make you feel like you can make a difference in the world or sort of make change, or make you feel like you have agency or autonomy, in the world as, growing something from a seed. It is a really just empowering and important experience that all people should have. And to just treasure it for that in and of itself.
That's so interesting when you say that you would like to see more automation technology as your biggest change. I guess I'm just like confused about what you mean by that. Like, are you thinking of something different than what I'm like thinking? Like, you're thinking you want to see more technology like in a garden?
Oh yeah, totally. I think it's just like the irrigation stuff we were just talking about. We are so wasteful with water, and we're frankly, it's wasteful not in just the water that is like not hitting the plant directly, but it's in sort of irrigating during non-peak times. Human involvement is like an inherently inefficient thing, and if we instead sort of channel our sort of time, money, and energy into building more efficient systems, that is what's going to benefit the world the most. But the sort of experience of growing something is a very like personal and sort of important one. But I sort of view the two as serving different purposes, right? Like when we're talking about a global food system, like that is not the space for people to like be doing like personal development. Like that's a space that needs to be it needs to function at a very high level of efficiency because it's just too important for inefficiency. And I mean, I really think that like the more technology involved, responsible technology, of course, but the more we can leverage tech in that space, the more sustainable, the better for the planet, the sort of cleaner and more efficient it will be. But I still think it's really important for people to have the physical experiences in ag, sort of at that hobby, personal, household level.
Cool. Oh, I'm with you there. I'm a total efficiency freak, and I like to do things that are the most efficient for everything. And I definitely get frustrated that people, like, I think I've like made this book called The Green Queen, and you would make the perfect green queen king. And it's about this little girl, and she like has a sunflower wand, and she is always yelling, like she's yelling at the golf course maintenance guy who's out there watering in the middle of the hot afternoon, and the sprinklers are just like dropping the water and it's evaporating before it barely even touches the ground. You know, so I understand what you're saying now better.
It's a thing. Yeah. And it's not just that. I mean, and there's this issue in, like, at least in the urban ag community that I am, like, personally, it is probably the thing I like least about the urban ag community is this sort of belief that if you didn't sort of break your back and sort of like grow something really inefficiently, that it somehow has less value. And it's sort of this distortion of, you know, the interest in handcrafted or artisanal goods that we've built this culture around that is really socially damaging. Yes, don't get me wrong. Like there are the technology in just even like greenhouse production isn't where it needs to be yet. You can still taste real differences between like outdoor grown tomatoes and like greenhouse production, mass produced ones. But like, that doesn't mean that one is like bad. It means that we need to be pushing that technology and that science forward. But there's just this whole sort of like population of people that somehow feel that if like human beings weren't sort of suffering in the process of creating something, that like it's of less value. I mean, it's like I have people that like, unless I saw somebody, you know, like middle-aged or a senior citizen, like with a hoe in their hand, like breaking their back literally, like then this tomato isn't good enough for me. And it's just like, it's ridiculous. The idea that we would need to sort of like do things in these inefficient or unnecessary ways, and that, you know, it's the idea that like people have to do things inefficiently for a product to have quality, that's kind of like my biggest beef in the world.
I totally understand what you're saying. And like I was talking about that Jay and Mandy Girth, and let me tell you, they've got to be efficient because they are going to feed 500 families in 26 weeks this summer. And I saw her plan, and she's like got these index cards, and she calls it like the ultimate Tetris game, like arranging those cards and figuring out. And she's the one that I was talking about. She does her tomato. Like, I wouldn't understand what you were talking about with tomatoes if I hadn't seen her tomatoes. Like, you know, and they have got to be the ultimate efficiency experts to be able to do all that on a very small piece of land and feeding 500 families, you know, providing the produce for them for the summer. That's a huge thing that they've taken on. Like, I can't even imagine it, because like what I see what it takes Mike to do to produce just the food for us, if he's just going to produce our vegetables, I can't imagine, because her place is not that much bigger than ours. But how she gets all that food out of there, it's totally being efficient. And I'm sure they have irrigation systems like you're talking about, and they do everything they can to maximize their production, and that's how they're able to do that. And they are a great business here in our local system. But anyway, I'm rambling. Tell listeners how to connect with you, how to find your awesome website, how they can see your videos, and just the cool agrihood that you've got going there, because it's just gorgeous and neat. And I understand why the property values are raising just from people being to have that in their neighborhood.
Best way to connect with us is on Facebook. I think it's like 50,000 followers now on our Facebook page. It's just the name of the org, the Michigan Urban Farming Initiative. Our website, www.miufi.org. Unfortunately, the medieval Unicode font initiative took MUFI.org, so we have this like not as clear URL, but our website, we've got like a built-in contact form. We're very text friendly. You can text our phone number. It's 313-444-6834. And we have open volunteer work days every single Saturday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. No need to sign up in advance. Come whenever you want, stay as long as you want. We're very relaxed about the administration and management of getting volunteers. And then, your people are always free to make donations. We're a nonprofit. We rely heavily on those, and we're trying to build new and efficient models to make the world a better place. And I do believe that it's like a worthy thing to donate to. And you can do that online as well.
Well, thank you so much. This went a lot longer than I'm sure you were expecting. My husband's probably like, what are you still doing on the phone? But have an awesome weekend in spring, and thanks for sharing with us today.
Yeah, totally. Thank you for having me.
Hey, Green Future Growers. Did you get your copy of the Organic Gardener podcast, Garden Journal, and Record Keeper? One of the things that I've learned to be most beneficial for my guests that will save you time and energy is to keep detailed records of your garden journey. So I think I finally found the secret and made a garden journal data keeper that starts any day of the year because you just fill it in. It's blank. There's no calendar. So it's got the days of the week. You can record temperature, freeze dates, frost dates, when you planted, what variety you got. All in one place. So get your copy of the Organic Gardener podcast, Garden Journal, and Data Keeper today. Hey there, Green Future Growers. Would you like your friends and neighbors to create an organic oasis too? Would you like others in your area to learn about earth-friendly practices for their gardens and yards? If so, we would love it if you would share the Organic Gardener podcast with your local community or college radio station today. Thanks again for listening, and remember, grow local.